across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello there. We really appreciate you downloading this podcast from the BBC. And don't forget, we're here fighting for you every day of the week. If you want to contact us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. I hope you enjoy today's podcast. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everyone. Bank Holiday Monday. The Nolan Show here with you from the BBC, 03030805555. So Gavin Robinson, the leader of the DUP, when he took over from Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, he said the DUP should have displayed cautious realism over the Stormont deal. He was saying and admitting that the DUP oversold at what they had achieved during Brexit. That's interesting, isn't it? Because those are political words and you stand back and there was a lot of discussion around it at the time. How's it actually playing out on the ground? Well, the next phase of Brexit hits Northern Ireland at the end of September. John Campbell, our business economics editor, is joining us this morning. Good morning to you, John.
Morning. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning. It's good morning. Happy bank holiday, John. Good to see you're working.
Thank you. Cheers.
So shipping of some parcels from Great Britain to Northern Ireland going to be affected here in September. What's happening? How's this play out?
That is the major change in September, is that there's going to be some new processes for parcels. And we just have to do a little bit of Brexit history here before we get to the meat of this, which is when the Northern Ireland Protocol was signed, that was effectively going to mean that virtually all commercial parcels from Great Britain to Northern Ireland would need a customs declaration. So everything coming out of online shopping warehouses in GB. That was never implemented. There was never even an attempt to implement it because business and the UK government said, listen, I know we signed up to this, but it's going to be unworkable. Eventually, the EU came around to that position, and in the Windsor framework, there was an agreement to radically simplify what had originally been agreed. Now, that still meant there was a requirement for some sort of new processes to give the EU a level of assurance that goods wouldn't be wrongly coming into its single market. So what they have come up with is that there's no changes at all for consumer-to-consumer parcels. So if somebody in England, say, for example, is sending you a birthday present or whatever, nothing changes there. For business-to-consumer parcels, so that's most of what we talk about in terms of online shopping, consumers won't have to do anything new. The change there, though, is that parcel companies will have to be signed up to this new Trusted Trader scheme. Now, it's been open for applications for a long time now. It's due to start at the end of September. I haven't heard any reports of any difficulties there. It's a bit more hassle for the companies. They have to send more information to the government. They have to show that they have processes in place to distinguish whether a parcel is going to a private individual or to a business. The major change, though, is going to be business-to-business parcels. So that's when a business in GB is sending a parcel to a business in Northern Ireland. Now, mostly businesses, when they're trading, they won't send their stuff via parcels. You know, they'll book a transport, they'll use a haulage company. Sometimes, though, they do need to use parcels, depending on their business or if they want to get something there quickly. For the first time, they are going to have the use of effectively a formal customs process to send those parcels. So if your parcels are not at risk of moving into the EU, then you know you use what is known as the UK internal market system. That used to be known as the Green Lane. So you have a simplified customs declaration effectively to fill out. If, however, your parcel is at risk of moving into the EU, then you have to use the full customs process. So that is where the change is actually going to be happening, and where there may be some differences seen. So we know already of one case. It was actually reported first by David Thompson of the Newsletter, formerly of this parish, and it concerns the pet food company Purina. They have a system where they would effectively sell pet food in bulk to breeders. So a breeder has a business, they can get lots of pet food in through parcels. Excuse me. They've said that they're basically going to end that service for Northern Ireland from the start of next month, because whatever these changes amount to for them, they can't make it work, and they say they hope to be able to bring it back maybe at some time in the future. So that is kind of one small example of how this could have an impact on some businesses. Now, I wouldn't expect it to be massive, but there are changes coming in which some businesses have to be prepared for.
But how is this possible? Because the DUP, before they come back into Stormont, said that new legislation would remove checks on goods moving within the UK and remaining in Northern Ireland. On customs paperwork, the DUP said, customs declarations, supplementary declarations will be gone. We believe this represents a significant change, they said.
So there's a couple of things, sorry, just to unpack there. So supplementary declaration is this kind of like longer piece of paperwork you would need to do after you got the goods initially. So they would move under a kind of simplified declaration, and then you'd have to file the supplementary declaration later. So that is gone. But you still have to do, for this class of parcels, business to business, you still have to do something. Now, once you're signed up on the Trusted Trader Scheme, it should mean that it's pretty minimal. And mostly what you're doing is just filling out the sort of details that you would have in the normal commercial invoice anyway. And when businesses are trading with each other, you do it through invoices. So really what the government are saying is, listen, yes, it's something new, but it's not much more than you already do. And it's significantly simpler than had originally been agreed at the time of the Northern Ireland Protocol. And I think you put that into the context of Gavin Robinson's words before the election, where he was saying, yes, effectively, we oversold what we got in the safeguarding the union deal, and this all remains a work in progress. I think, though, you know, the
and some people will be wondering, John, and obviously you're not going to comment on this, but some people will be wondering, when Gavin talked about the DUP overselling something, does that mean they spoofed to the people who vote for them?
Well, six of one, half dozen of the other. You know, there was a big selling. You know, once when you get a deal, a political deal, generally you'll push the positives. You know, you want to people to kind of get behind it. So you go out and you'll kind of sell the positives about it, and you won't get into too much of the negatives. A bit like when Boris Johnson did, you know, the original Northern Ireland Protocol. You know, it was a great deal. You know, there's not going to be, any. You know, throw the paperwork in the bin, all that sort of stuff. You know, didn't get into the nitty gritty detail of what it actually involved. I think, though, you know, a big picture thought on all of this is, throughout the Brexit process in Northern Ireland, what the government has tried to do is to keep any new things away from consumers as much as possible, and push all the hassle on to businesses. The calculation being there that businesses, if they've got some new process to deal with, they're at least equipped to deal with it in a way that consumers wouldn't be. And I think that's the general thrust of what they're aiming to do with parcels as well. The idea is that people doing their normal shopping with Amazon or whatever shouldn't notice anything new from the end of September. But behind the scenes, businesses, parcel companies, they will have to do some new things. And that is basically in keeping with the way they've tried to play it all along.
What about then, look, if they're playing it legit, obviously they could pretend it was for themselves, right? But if they're playing it legit, a local joiner. So I had to get knobs for my kitchen cupboards, and the joiner ordered them from across the water. Mm-hmm. Now, if he's doing that on a regular basis, and he's a single trader, he's a single guy, he's out there, he's trying to earn a living, has he got to start to fill in that paperwork, or does he just...
It's his provider, whoever's sending them from the other side, they would have to sort out the paperwork. But like I say, it's mostly whenever businesses are buying stuff from suppliers in GB, they're not going to be sending them as parcels. They're going to be booking a transport, a haulage company. They'll be bringing in, you know, a reasonable amount of stuff on a lorry or on a pallet. And those goods are already subject to... the Irish Sea border processes. So the change here is, if you're bringing stuff in through parcels, which can be reasonably an expensive way to move stuff. So you really usually do it if you really have to, like, for example, if you have to get goods in a rush. So we're not sure of the kind of the impact of this yet. And generally, you know, the way mostly Brexit has worked is business has muddled through, and they've kind of made it work. The concern of the Chamber of Commerce here is that Government this time is not paying enough attention to this. They're saying that they need to have kind of clearer instruction and guidance to people about what is happening at the end of September. And I think sort of the big picture, what some of the business organisations are worried about, is that the UK government wants to really strike a new deal ultimately with the EU, which would be probably good for Northern Ireland, would lessen the impact of the Irish Sea border. But in the meantime, the government said, listen, we are going to, in good faith, implement the Northern Ireland or implement the Windsor framework. So I think what business organisations are worried about is that in some ways we become a bit of collateral damage. The word goes out, listen, we don't want to hear about your problems, just get on with it because there's a bigger prize we're concentrating on here. And the business organisations are really thinking, well, no, hold on a minute. You know, you need to continue to help us and to make sure that these things are implemented proportionately.
If it is minimal amount of paperwork, easily done, easily filled in, why is the Northern Ireland Chamber of Commerce so concerned? Why?
It's just this issue. I think those twofold issues. One, making sure that everybody knows the specifics of what they're going to have to do from the end of September. And as ever, one of the issues is generally Northern Ireland businesses have been kind of well prepared and well on top of this stuff. It's been the GB suppliers all along have been the problems where, you know, suddenly it creeps up on them and they haven't realised what they've needed to do. So they're just anxious that that doesn't happen again. And then there's that bigger picture of making sure that the UK government continues to engage with these practical issues in Northern Ireland and that they don't fall down the list of priorities as the government is trying to, if you like, do the bigger piece of work with the EU in terms of trying to reach some kind of better deal somewhere further down the road. And I think in some ways business is quite content with the new Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, who, you know, among all UK politicians has been across the Brexit issues in a way which has been very forensic and detailed, and he's got a deep understanding of it. I think the bigger worry in local businesses, well, aside from him, are there others further up the level of seniority within government and the Cabinet Office who are approaching these issues with the same degree of seriousness? So, if you like, these changes coming up at the start of or the end of September, that is one thing, but then there's also this bigger picture of where this ultimately goes in the end.
And John, you've helpfully explained that this does not apply to people sending, like, buying something off Amazon or eBay or wherever it is from across the water to here. This is about business sending things on packages. And then you said, look, that the essentially you were saying the Irish Sea border already exists in circumstances where goods are being sent here. In what circumstances, John? On pallets, is that right?
Stuff that's been brought by hauliers. So, you know, there's a process which has been in place there since the Northern Ireland Protocol started being implemented, you know, where there is the kind of the range of paperwork and process that mostly the hauliers have to deal with on behalf of businesses. So that has already, you know, been there and is
and that's paperwork, that's customs checks, is it?
Yeah. Well, it's some of it is, so the actual physical checks generally aren't for customs. It's the paperwork is there. So basically you have to have certain documents which are processed before you'll get the load onto the boat. Most of the checking which takes place is on food and agri products. They're sort of regulatory checks. There's like three different level of checks there. And actually, there's another thing coming at the start of September which should reduce the level of those checks, because if you remember, there was a whole fuss over the not for EU labelling on food products coming from GB into Northern Ireland. That is going to be extended to a broader range of products. The flip side of that is that the percentage of goods which have to be actually be given what's known as an identity check at the ports, so somebody opens the bag and looks, is that what it says it is? That is going to come down, and then that will come down again once the not for EU labelling is fully rolled out. So it's food products where the majority of the checks take place, and the aim is that over time the volume of those checks should start to come down, and it's a condition of the deal that they will come down.
What happens, for example, with cars when cars are brought into Northern Ireland? What happens there?
Well, it's just like anything else. You know, you have to have the correct paperwork in place to move those. If you're moving as a business-to-business movement, so if there's a car transporter coming over from Scotland to Northern Ireland, you have to have a manifest saying what it is and, you know, where it's going and all that sort of stuff. And you have to have the goods movement reference and all the bits and pieces that are needed.
I guess some people, John, listening to this morning, look, Jim Alistair's about to come on today. I guess some people listening might think to themselves, there was a whole furore around the what ifs and how would unionists feel having to fill in some of this, having to have this paperwork filled in, movement of goods from one part of the UK to another. But actually, it's being done and people are getting on with it. Is that fair?
Yeah, so, you know, there have, you know, at various points during the Brexit process, there's, you know, been apocalyptic predictions about what was going to happen. You know, there'd be a total collapse of supply chains and all the rest of it. None of that happened. And, you know, for a couple of reasons. One is what was originally agreed, for example, in the case of parcels, was never implemented because what the government had signed up to was practically unworkable. It's somewhat mitigated by the Windsor framework. And then you have businesses will be adaptable. They'll learn by doing. There's new stuff they have to do. They don't like it, but they'll do it anyway because they know they have to do it in order to get the goods in. And the way in which the government, as I said earlier, have always tried to manage this is to try and keep any changes well away from consumers and just basically push all the change onto business because they're better equipped to deal with it. So, you know, it's like at the very start of the, you know, the implementation of Brexit in Northern Ireland, there were fears about, you know, would some of the supermarkets pull out? Because of the hassle of getting food products across. Now, obviously, that hasn't happened, and even some of the loudest complainers, like Marks and Spencers, continue to expand their food business. There have been some changes around the edges, where some products have been delisted, but for the most part, if you're somebody going to a supermarket, you know, it's the same supermarkets selling much the same stuff as happened before Brexit, and you know, they've found a way to make it work, even if it's hassle.
Well, Jim Alistair, the leader of the TV, is with us this morning. So as John was describing that all to us, Jim, it's all working. We're getting on with it. The optics and the, I guess that you will not like the fact that there is this paperwork to be done from one part of the UK to the other. But the point is, the economy's continuing. Goods are continuing to come into Northern Ireland, Jim. Keep everything in perspective. What's the problem?
Well, the point is, if you're a unionist, it's an assault, a very physical assault upon your constitutional position, because this is only happening because Northern Ireland and Northern Ireland alone within the United Kingdom has been left subject to the EU's customs code, which itself decrees GB to be a foreign country. Therefore, goods coming from GB must go through all these customs processes. That is the constitutional effect and assault of this, and that can never be made bearable for unionists if you believe in the union at all. Yes, they're trying to tinker and to make it more malleable, but that does not deal with the fundamental constitutional affront that is involved. But, you know, well, the other side of this is this, that businesses who are suppliers from GB, Northern Ireland being a relatively small market, a number of them are saying it's not worth the effort. We've had that with the food, with the pet.
Well, we've seen David Thompson's story, as John says, about the pet food. But are you hearing of any other company pulling out?
Well, I was the one that heard about that one and drew attention to it. And yes, there are other companies, small companies, who say, well, we're quite happy to sell to Northern Ireland, provided there's no other paperwork involved. Well, I'm not naming companies at this moment in time, but I'm aware that there are others. They're not bothered. They're not prepared to deal with the paperwork because it's extra cost. And that's the other side of this. It's not just about the fact that the intolerable situation that you have to have customs declarations to trade within your own country, that you have to be in a trusted trader scheme to trade within your own country. It's the fact that all of that costs money, and those costs inevitably are passed on to the consumers, and that is the continuing price.
Jim, I hear you. I hear you that you're calling this a constitutional assault. I hear it, and you're entitled to do so. But do you concede that in terms of the practical business on the ground, it's continuing relatively uninterrupted.
Well, it's continuing at cost because paperwork costs. It means extra staff. There have been many stories of companies having to employ extra staff, and that translates into extra costs for consumers. So there is a cost. We cannot wipe it away. And it is intolerable that anyone to trade within the same country should have to make customs declarations. That doesn't happen in any other country in the world. That to trade internally, you must have make customs declarations. Customs declarations relate to trade from foreign country to foreign country, not internal. And that is the irreducible offence of this, that we trade within Northern Ireland, we're being treated because the customs code treats GB as a foreign country.
John, those costs that Jim is talking about, have they been absorbed by business or have they been passed on to us, the consumer?
It's hard to work that out because you'll have as costs at a level across the whole economy, they were pretty diffuse. So in some cases, businesses will absorb them. In some cases, they will have put up prices. That is difficult to untangle from the kind of the general burst of goods inflation that we have had over the past couple of years. There was some economic modelling done, which was based upon the Northern Ireland Protocol, which actually had, if you like, more onerous requirements, which was attempting to quantify what those costs would be. But, you know, fundamentally, if you add costs onto a business, they have to show up in one of two main ways, which is either it's higher costs for consumers or it's lower profits for business. But I think it's quite difficult for us to quantify exactly what those costs will be based on the current set of arrangements that we have. But it is, you know, you look at, you know, the impact of Brexit overall, and it is kind of inflationary. It does add costs. You know, you just need to read some of the stories about the impact of the processes in terms of moving goods from EU into GB, which have started to be tightened over the last number of months there. And suddenly you have food companies in particular facing very large bills for the admin costs of moving stuff through the border control posts in the southeast of England. So, yes, there is cost. It's cost all the way down. But in terms of exactly how that is distributed across the economy, we don't have a brilliant picture of that yet.
And then before you both go, we have this Sunday Times story yesterday. The UK electricity regulator is questioning the viability of two interconnectors between Britain and Ireland after research said the project would cost the UK consumer $2.2 billion over 25 years. So, John, the bottom line here is it would benefit Northern Ireland but not Great Britain. So it's been questioned. Is that right?
Yeah, it would. Well, it's important to realise that the wholesale electricity market on the island of Ireland is a single market. So wholesale electricity is organised on a 32-county basis. So when we're talking about wholesale electricity, it's the island of Ireland as a whole. What was planned here is two additional electricity interconnectors, one from Scotland into Northern Ireland and a second one, I think, from Wales into the Republic. Ofgem, which is the energy regulator in GB, they have to have a role or a say in this to whether this connection would be good for GB consumers. There's actually a total of 8 interconnectors in GB, some going onto the continent, which they have looked at. They've given an initial assessment that they only think one of them kind of meets the mark in terms of value for money, and there are issues with the 7 other ones. Those two, the one coming into Northern Ireland, the one planned to come into the Republic, effectively they're saying it's because electricity prices tend to be higher on the island of Ireland through what's known as the single electricity market. Once you had those interconnectors in place, mostly what would happen is you would have electricity moving from GB into Ireland. That therefore would increase demand on the GB generators. And when you have increased demand, that tends to put prices up, force prices up. So what they're saying is, well, we think just that because it would all be going one way from GB into Ireland. The prices would go up in GB. That would be bad for GB consumers because we wouldn't have much electricity coming back the other way from Ireland. Now, there's probably a question there about why the single electricity market has consistently higher prices than those in the GB market. That is a very complicated question, which you probably are not going to get to the bottom of today.
Definitely not.
But the upshot,
I can hardly understand upshot, this, never mind more.
The upshot is that the GB energy regulator does not think these interconnectors are a good idea. This is not the end of the story, though. That was an initial decision. There was further consultation and representations to be made. And then Ofgem, they will make a final decision, I think, sometime in the coming weeks about whether these will happen or not.
I'll tell you, Jim Allister, what you can understand. Sinn Féin in this Lucid Talk poll from the Belfast Telegraph has increased its lead as Northern Ireland's largest party. DUP support has plummeted. What is going on?
Well, it's quite clear that TUV support is up. Indeed, the last
Lucid
Talk poll... 4 points. The last Lucid Talk poll put TUV on 5. They're now putting us on 9. Of course, they've massaged down the pre-election poll to put us on 5. And, of course, the election showed that, in fact, we were scoring at 8.
Anything.
Well, that's your opinion. The election scored us at 8. We're now on 9, but according to Lucid Talk, at the time of the election, we should only have been on 5.
But look where Sinn Féin is with this Lucid Talk poll. Look at this one poll, and polls suggest things. You have to look at them over trends and over many years and all of that that comes together. But Sinn Féin, 30%, by far the biggest party in Northern Ireland, Jim.
Which I think is up just 1 point, if I recall correctly, on their last poll. So it's not statistically
correct,
significant.
But you've got Sinn Féin at 30% and the DUP at 18%.
Well, the DUP is in decline because the DUP lied to the electorate. The first part of this discussion was an underscoring of that, that they told us the RDC border was gone, and then they're surprised that the electorate, when they discovered that they'd been lied to, turned on the DUP. Of course they did, and so they should. Because the fundamental of politics is you need to be honest with people. And if you're not honest with people, then you can't expect their support.
Well, Gavin Robertson described it as it having been oversold.
Oversold is a nice way of saying we lied to you.
One of the interesting things within this poll, and Suzanne Breen's writing about this in the Belfast Telegraph, unionists are 6 times more likely than nationalists to say that our current immigration rate is too high. Six
well,
times more
high.
Likely.
Well, I don't think the differential really matters. The question is it too high?
It does. It's really interesting. Why would that be?
It may be interesting, but it patently is too high. You know, we have our health service under immense pressure, contributed to in part by over-immigration. We have our education and sectors under pressure, and we don't have money for all of that. So immigration, which is uncontrolled, and we saw that over the summer again with the boats and all of that, is something which is a contributor to that.
But if it is about housing and access to the NHS, Jim, that applies to people in nationalist communities as well, which is why the question as to why it would be more than 6 times as many unionists as nationalists who say the current level of immigration is too high. What do you put that down to?
Another interesting dimension of that is that it would seem that nationalists in the Republic think that it's too high. There seems to be evidence that in the Republic, the general consensus is it's too high. I can't explain why nationalists take a different view in Northern Ireland, but if they do, they do. But I'm certainly very clear that from my perspective, the immigration levels are too high.
Net immigration for 2022 showed 2,200 people, Jim, in for net immigration into Northern Ireland. Are you talking about the whole of the UK?
I'm talking about the whole of the UK. I'm a UK unionist, and the net migration into the UK has been far too high. And
what about Northern Ireland?
Well, Northern Ireland equally as part of the United Kingdom, and indeed under the protocol, we had a High Court case which was set to make us a dumping ground in terms of migration because we were unable if the Rwanda scheme had proceeded, to implement that here. Because
but you're not blaming immigration on the waiting list in Northern Ireland, are you? You're not doing that.
Sorry?
You're not blaming waiting lists on immigration into Northern Ireland, Jim, are you? It's not what you're doing.
I'm not specifically doing that, but obviously if there are more people to be catered for, wherever they come from, then the health service is going to creak even more. And the reality of migration is that it creates more people to cater for.
And when you say more people to cater for, how many people are actually working in the NHS who have come here?
Yes, there is a dimension to that, that there are, our health service is reliant on a good number of people who come in. And that's why I believe in a migration policy, which is merit-based, where you have a need, where you cannot meet that need locally, then on a point system, you should bring in the expertise that you need. That involves you bringing people into the health service, then do it. But this open door policy of migration is the one which is causing the problems.
Editor of Sligo Tún McFeelty with us today as well. We'll say thank you to John Campbell this morning. John, thank you very much indeed. Mick, Jim's tried to, I've asked him a number of times as to why sixfold as many unionists as nationalists say the current level of immigration is too high. Jim's not that plussed about delving into that, but I'm intrigued. Why would that be the case?
Well, because it's been, look, I mean, Brexit, this goes back to Brexit. Jim's party most enthusiastically supported Brexit. And
somebody's turned the radio on in the background.
Yeah, I don't know, it's not me.
Okay, carry on, sir.
Sorry. So look, unionism was mostly in favour of Brexit. Now, there were some obvious dissenters. The Ulster Unionists didn't whip people. The DUP got on board. TUV got on board. And much of that is concerns around migration. But as you were trying to point out to Jim there, Northern Ireland doesn't particularly suffer from an over-immigration problem. Community relations where migrant workers have settled in and are doing useful jobs that are a benefit to the local community, generally speaking, there's not a huge amount of rancor there. So there's no real local problem with that. One of the problems, I think, that unionism has got itself tied into is that it has foregrounded concerns around national policy that it has absolutely no control over. And I think this is one of the reasons why it's so deeply divided in the way that nationalism simply isn't. And I think that's part of a wider general drift where local politicians are getting wrapped up in issues that they have no power over. So there's nothing been done about housing. There's a major housing crisis in Northern Ireland. None of the major political parties, nationalist or unionist, are offering to do anything about that. But getting wrapped up in what are effectively, in terms of the job and the responsibility that they have, are political abstractions that they have no control over. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why you have that sixfold interest in migration, though, in practical terms, it's not a major issue for Northern Ireland.
Jim?
Well, I reject the suggestion that Northern Ireland people shouldn't be interested in national politics.
I'm not saying
we elect people. We elect people like myself to the national parliament for that very reason, because we should have a say and do have a say on these issues. And certainly, national politics are something that I want to have a voice in. And migration is one of those issues which is very prevalent and needs to be addressed.
That's fine, Jim. And you're right to point out that as a member of parliament, that is part of the purview and the things that you've got to take account of. But look, let's set aside that you're the only TUV MP there. There are a number of other unionist MPs who share your outlook on that particular international problem. Your basic problem as an MP is you don't have the numbers to affect any of these outcomes. Whereas in the Assembly, where you do have the numbers, a lot of these domestic issues that are filling into some of the concerns that particularly working class communities have around immigration, there's simply nothing being done. And that's one of the reasons why unionism is in such such high dudgeon over these issues.
Well, I think there's a great loophole here. And Stormont has no powers over migration whatsoever. It is a national issue. However, it's only Westminster that can deal with it. Stormont can whistle in the dark about it as much as it likes, but there's no powers.
Yeah, but in Stormont, you do have the power to build houses. You have power over planning. You have all manner of things that would allow some of those marginalised communities that are concerned about immigration. You could ameliorate some of the pressures on those communities so that we could have a more rational and less emotional conversation about the whole subject of immigration and skill shortages and all those other things.
If you had the money and didn't think the things at Caseness Park were a greater priority, then no doubt you could deal with housing shortage. And there's housing shortage in my constituency and elsewhere. And those
right
issues
right across Northern Ireland. Yeah.
It does all come down to an issue of prioritising money, something Stormont hasn't been very good at, frankly.
Well, we're in agreement
Ken,
there.
Ken calling us this morning. Morning, Ken.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Ken.
How you doing? Just to let you know that I was due for a van replacement on my leasing company in Vanarama, which is based in England, in early September, and they have contacted me to tell me to stop supplying Northern Ireland because of Brexit.
No, are you sure it's because of Brexit? Because that could just be a business decision.
No,
did they say that?
Well, I asked them the reason. He says it's because of Brexit. And they apologised, and they gave me a couple of our names of people in Northern Ireland that might have been able to help me. I went to them, but they're more expensive. Vanarama was very reasonable on their prices.
Well, why would it be because of Brexit?
I can't understand that.
Jamalister, do you know a leasing company in GB not wanting to lease here? Why?
Well, again, it comes back to, and it's not because of Brexit, it's because of the protocol, which retained us under EU law, and it's EU law that insists that there must be these customs declarations, which adds to the cost, which drives companies in England to say, well, it's not worth the candle, we're not going to do it, go elsewhere. And it all comes back to the fact that we have been marooned in a foreign jurisdiction under foreign laws governing our own internal trade. That's the absurdity of all of this.
Dan, next morning, Dan.
The other dimension of this, and of the facts even down to the issue of parcels, etc., is that if GB companies decline to supply because of the extra hassle and costs, then that is driving a trade elsewhere, as driving trade on a north-south basis, which, of course, is the political intent of the protocol.
Morning, Dan.
Good morning, Stephen.
Go ahead,
Stephen,
sir.
You said in the programme earlier on, John Campbell said that, the government's saying that everything which is happening now has been agreed in the original protocol. Well, who ever agreed it? Nobody. No, we didn't agree it. Nobody agreed that in the first place. And secondly, you're actually playing down the impact of the cost of Northern Ireland, because you now have not for sale labels in all the supermarkets, and there's actually a not for sale label on.
What do you mean not for sale? If it's in a supermarket, it's for sale.
Pardon?
What do you mean? If it's in a supermarket, it's for sale. What do you mean?
Yes, it's for sale. But there's the added cost of the paperwork involved in adding that not for sale label onto Irish whiskey, not for sale in the EU. So why are we paying for such ridiculous things? And you, when have you ever had anybody from the European Union on your programme explain to me why I must accept their laws, which I don't vote for, which nobody votes for here. And every time Stephen Nolan talks about the democracy in this country, he makes a complete hypocrite of himself.
All right, it's my fault now. It was only a matter of time that it was all my fault.
No, it's not your fault. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying when you describe, when you talk in your daily programs about democracy in Northern Ireland, how can we have democracy when you when you're a condominium of a foreign country making laws which increase inflation
because
in Northern
you're
Ireland?
British Prime Minister signed off on all of this.
Absolutely.
That's your democracy.
Yes.
Your
Absolutely.
British Prime
and
Minister signed off on it all, and the largest unionist party in Northern Ireland also said that it was all gone. It was gone. There was no RSC border. That was the pronouncement of the DUP.
And when Gavin Robertson says it was oversold
and there should have been cautious realism and there should have been all of this, Gavin Robertson was in the party, standing shoulder to shoulder with Geoffrey Johnson when it was being said. So
yes.
That's your democracy.
Could I speak? Would you let me speak, for goodness sake? You're talking over the top. I'm a unionist vote, a DUP voter. I have been betrayed, let down. I know, and you're talking about immigration. You talk about, you're intrigued as why so many unionists are against immigration in Northern Ireland. It's simply because you had a speaker in that New Ireland, conference there in Belfast, and he said that you have to be very nice to immigrants because they, in the future, they could have the swing vote in a united Ireland. And that's what unionists say. That's exactly why they're so up about immigration.
Because they see it as a way of being outvoted
in Northern Ireland. And the protocol is a prime example of how unionists are demoralised. Because you have transfers.
Are they, though? McVitie, do you get a sense... Do you get a sense, Mick, they're demoralised? Or, for the vast majority of unionists, do they not care?
Look, I mean, if you look at the polling and you look at the outcomes in the July general election, unionism is still sitting at about 40%. Now, it's a minority. And I think that this is what some of your speakers need to understand. Unionism is no longer in a solid majority. And I've heard people like your caller talking about the demoralization of unionism for the last 20 years. I started Slugger O'Toole on the back of a very thoughtful piece of research into unionism. And this thread of pessimism has been there for a long time. And all it does is it shrinks the attractiveness of the union and political unionism itself. Unionism, if it wants to stop being demoralized, has to come up with some kind of vision for Northern Ireland within the United Kingdom. It doesn't need to do that to defend the union, because most of the people who have left it are now voting for parties like Alliance and even the Green Party are not necessarily hot to trot for a United Ireland. And the whole prospect of United Ireland, I think, is still some way off in the distance. So the disaster that people are feeding off and feeding their own personal fantasies of demoralization and defeat and all the rest of it are not any more real than the fantasies of a United Ireland next Tuesday week, which were constantly being pushed at us by Ireland's Future and Sinn Féin and, to a much lesser extent, the SDLP. That these are all things that are still a very long way off in the future, if they ever happen at all.
Is Sinn Féin's dominance down to the personalities of the leader? Is Michelle O'Neill a very effective leader? And is it down to that? Is it down to their policies? Why are they sitting on 30%? DUP 18% on this one?
I don't think it's personality. I don't think we haven't seen any sudden jumps. What we've seen is a consolidation under Michelle O'Neill. But Michelle O'Neill and Sinn Féin generally for most of the last 20 years have been careful not to take any political risks over almost any issue whatsoever. Unlike the DUP, who took a risk in 2016 in backing the Brexit referendum. And again, I go back to the point I made to Jim earlier. It's fine to do it. I understand and I respect the principles and the belief behind it. But when you as a political party start to make gambits that you can't, the outcomes of which you cannot control, and you put it into the hands of another political party
in the sovereign parliament in Westminster, you're asking for trouble. That kind of explains the sort of collapse of the DUP from, as it was, around about 28, 29, 30%, now down to below 20, although I think in the July election they had 22%, so you were talking about a plus or minus 3% margin of error there. The other reason why Sinn Féin is now dominant is because it has a political machine that is incomparable to any other political machine. It dominates nationalism west of the band, where nationalism dominates unionism. So there's a large sum of voters that are based in areas which are basically uncontested. When you come east of the band, it's an absolute free-for-all. You've got Jim at the TUV, you've got the DUP competing with the UUP and TUV. You've got Alliance, which are kind of slowly eating the edge of the Ulster Unionist Party east of the band, but hardly present west of the band. You've got the SDLP in there in South Belfast. You've got Sinn Féin in North Belfast and West Belfast. So and you've got People Before Profit in West Belfast with one assembly seat. Everything east of the band is super competitive. Everything west of the band is simply almost a one-party state.
Okay.
So they're sitting on a kind of a huge platform, while on the other hand, unionism is eating itself over issues like Brexit that it simply cannot control.
Robert next. Morning, Robert.
Hello.
Go ahead, Robert.
I'm on this old known show.
Yes, you are. It's me. Go ahead, sir.
I'm a small operator here in Mid-Ulster, importing a simple product like barley straw. Now, since Brexit come, after I had paid for doing 50 or 60 loads imported at a cost of almost £2,000, which I have to absorb or pass on to reluctant farmers who are struggling at the minute to pay their bills. I have dairy farmers, can't pay me until they get their single farm payment in September. I've had our dairy farmers who couldn't pay me until they got their VAT back. And to explain to them that the product, just say for a ballpoint figure, is costing £70 a bale, that, oh, by the way, it's plus £2 a bale for paperwork. 90% of them think that you're lying. A small percentage understands that there is paperwork involved, but they didn't know it was at a cost. Jeffrey Donaldson stood up a few months back and he said, I've got all paperwork abolished, which was a complete and utter lie. So it just makes my blood boil that I could say reject that load of straw in Northern Ireland here today and sell it back to mainland UK without paperwork.
And are you saying £2,000 of extra costs?
You have to find it. You can't get a load of straw. I'm loading straw in England today. Lucky enough, I spent money and bought a new laptop. I got self-taught, which was a nightmare. If you don't do the paperwork, you don't get in.
But are you saying, Robert, £2,000 of extra costs?
You have to find 150 per bale. If you're 40 bales on at £60, and somebody has to absorb that. And I take less profit, or I have to pass it on to a struggling farmer. And the thing that bugs me is Jeffrey Donaldson stood up. I'm sure you're well aware of it. I'm sure you heard the statement yourself. I have got all paperwork abolished, goods coming from UK remaining in Northern Ireland.
Robert, it was not just, it's a misnomer to describe this as it was just Jeffrey Donaldson. It was the DUP as a political party. It was all of them. Yes, Sir Jeffrey was leading the charge, but it was all of them. They as a political party, wasn't every member, but it was the political party, the DUP, that were selling you this message that the Irish Sea border was gone.
Yeah, it's not gone. It's not gone, or never will be gone. And it's a cost that we're going to have to absorb or pass on, which straw with haulage from mainland UK is expensive enough. And I come to you and I say, Stephen, I'll hold on. Just for an approximate figure, we say that the straw's costing £70 a bale. I'll hold on, Stephen. I need to add on £1.50 a bale for paperwork. You're going to look at me and say, what are you on about? What planet are you on? We're in the UK. Are we not in the UK? No. I don't know where we're at. We're just...
You said you had to teach yourself. You had to teach yourself what?
Well, there was a good lady pulled me out at the start to do the paperwork. And after she had done 50 loads for me, out of her own goodwill, she says, Robert, why don't you go and buy yourself a laptop? Come down to me, spend the day with me, and I'll try and tutor you to what to do. Now, I could give you £1,000, and I guarantee you couldn't do the paperwork in a full day for one load. It's that complicated. Complicated, yes, at the start. Complicated now for me? No. But the ordinary man or farmer in the street who wants to import that load of straw on his own and employ some of the local hauliers to bring it in, the hauliers is going to charge him £60 to £80 for customs paperwork, or he's not going to get it in.
Well, I'm going to read to you once again what the DUP told you. Goods moving between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, no longer physical checks or identity checks, save where there are suspicions of smuggling or criminal activity. On customs paperwork, customs declarations, supplementary declarations will be gone, said the DUP. And it is a significant change, said the DUP.
Complete, and every word of it's a lie, because I am no littler than 1 hour ago doing paperwork to bring a load of straw, which we're loading in Lincolnshire today. You need a shed. Oh. You ever tell a like it, you need a shed, a C-H-E-D. You need a GMR. And I would safely say you wouldn't even have a clue what a GMR was.
No, I've no idea what a... No.
Along with 99% of the people in Northern Ireland. And that's why, for the first time in my life, as a unionist voter, the DUP didn't get my vote at the last election.
Well, Gavin Robinson, to be fair to him, when he became leader, he did say that they had oversold the deal, and he said there should have been cautious realism within the party. Let me bring in David. Morning, David.
Good morning. I'll back all up what Robert said there. You're talking about the DUP, like it's nothing to do with me. I think you should be on getting the DUP on and saying, why have you told the people this? But aside from that, I would like to speak to John Campbell. He thinks the Trusted Trader Scheme is a walk in the park. I'd like him to come down and fill in my declaration.
I don't think he said that.
Well, he says it's just a paper exercise. You know, people in the public probably don't realise. I do a paper exercise every quarter for the VAT man, at my expense. I'm an unpaid servant of the government. People who pay wages out and pay AYE are unpaid servants of the government. Trusted Trader Schemes are now unpaid servants of the government. Like, I was bringing in pallets from Birmingham area, £45-50 a pallet, now £130 a pallet.
What?
Yes, what? Yes, what?
It's tripled. It hasn't trebled because of Brexit.
TSS.
It hasn't trebled because of the Trusted Trader Scheme now. Come on.
Well, you get onto it. You find out. You see, if you can bring me in a pallet from Birmingham area, get your researches, get the cost.
A pallet of what?
A pallet of anything.
But what are you bringing in?
A haulier doesn't worry what's on a pallet. He charges you the cubic metre, whereas a Euro pallet or a 4x4 pallet, and you pay by weight or measurements, whichever is the greatest.
You guys
need to wise up. This guy, John Campbell, coming on and saying, you know, he's the expert, and saying trust is greater. Like, it's only a sort of a walk in the park, a few bits of paperwork, and everything's happening.
Look, would you send us, first of all, John Campbell, is an expert. He's as good an expert as I can find.
But I'm sure
John and I.
I'm just Joe Boggs. I would like you to put John Campbell on the air with me some morning, and we'll walk through a trusted traders game, and many things you have to fill out. Like, for instance, if you were asked the question, bringing goods from the GP, country of origin, what would you put down?
What do you put down?
No, I'm asking you. What would you put down?
I'm not filling the form. What do you put down?
No. I'm asking you the question.
Right.
What would you put down if you were asked country of origin?
Robert, unfortunately, here's the news. At 10 o'clock. Morning, everyone. Now, none of you are going to believe this, right? True story this, I promise. So about a week ago, I got one of these steamer things for the tiles in the house. And I decided I'm going to do it. I'm going to clean the floors. So got up, cleaned the floor in the kitchen. It was soaking wet. Now, I don't do that often. So what happens? Slipped. Didn't fall down directly, just down. I went up. So I slipped and I went up in the air and then down, flattened my back. And I lay there and I thought, and I thud with the weight of me, of course, right? 19 stone. I thought, oh my goodness, what have I done here? So I lay there kind of startled for about 4 or 5 minutes. I was frightened of moving. And then I was able to get up and I was relatively okay. A wee bit sore, relatively okay. 2-3 days later, a pain in my rib cage at the front of my belly on the right hand side. This really sharp pain, and it just got worse and worse and worse till Saturday night. There at the weekend, I'm breathing and I'm not able to breathe totally deeply. And when I cough, it's really sore. So I stop coughing and all this mucus building up in my chest. It gets sore and sore and sore to the point where I took last night off work. Off 5 Live, I was trying to... Now, Sunday I've started to get slightly better. And I'm slightly better today again. My question to all of you listening is this. If you've bruised your ribs or you've hurt yourself somehow, do they just repair naturally? Because that's what I'm being told. You just got to go through the pain and wait for it. Other people are saying if you injure your ribs, get yourself up to hospital, get yourself checked out in case something's happened. I'm looking for your experiences if this has happened to you. 030-30-80-55-55. And of course, if you are ever in any doubt, make sure you check with your doctor. Before we get into the next story about Kirsty Allsopp, it's a good story as well. The Assume Nothing team, as you were hearing in the news, has a two-part special on the search for the body of Robert Nirak. It investigates the background to the hunt, includes an exclusive interview with a Republican source who spent decades trying to get to the IRA, trying to get the IRA to reveal where he was buried. So it's on BBC Sound, search for Assume Nothing, SAS, the secret search for Captain Nirak, and remember to hit subscribe. Right, I want to get stuck into this Kirsty Allsopp story. She's told the BBC that she felt sick after being contacted by social services for allowing her 15-year-old son to go interrailing around Europe. She said that her son had returned from 3 weeks travelling abroad with another teenage friend. There were no parents there. Off they went. Her kid was 15. The other kid was 16. She said that Kensington and Chelsea Council informed her that the matter had been referred to social services. Here she is speaking to BBC Radio 4's Broadcasting House.
Oscar's birthday is the 21st of July. He's a summer-born child, like many children. So his cohort have all turned 16. And like many kids who are at Reading or Leeds or Broadmasters or in, you know, travelling in Europe, there are some who are a bit younger simply because of their cohort. And confidence comes from trust and independence and from doing things by yourself. And my son is capable. It was his idea, his plan, his savings. He came to me and said, can I do this? I saw no reason for saying no. Mm. And when I mentioned that he'd done it, I wanted to be inspiring.
So that's what got her into bother. Social services were on the ball. Kuli Suma, interim chief executive of Parenting Focus NI. You've got a new job, Kula. Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. First things first, Stephen, your ribs. Please don't ask for medical advice from the general public. Follow your own advice and go and see a doctor. When you finish at 10:30, get yourself to a doctor and get yourself checked out. So let's get down to business.
That's just seeping through now. You care about me. You pretended when you were children's commissioner not to. It's seeping through. The mask has slipped. You do like me, Kula Yasuma.
I've never said I didn't like you, Stephen. And the idea of you lying on your kitchen floor on Fantasy Island hurt, and then all that pain, get yourself seen. Doesn't matter what Google or anyone says to you about broken ribs, get yourself checked out. Anyway, let's get Emma Wolfe joining us as well.
Commentator Emma Wolfe. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning, Stephen. I cracked a couple of... Ribs. I fractured a couple of ribs coming off my bike a few years ago. So I would agree, definitely get yourself checked out. But in terms of what they can do, not a lot, probably.
See,
and ribs tend, I mean, it may be that they strap you up, but in general, ribs tend to heal up on their own. But it is painful. It hurts to cough. It hurts to laugh too much. It hurts to do other things, which I won't mention, which sort of put pressure on your rib cage. So, yeah, definitely get yourself scanned and checked out by a doctor, but they may not be able to do very much.
Yeah.
Let's get into the Kirsty Allsop story. Kula, 15-year-old, gone off interrailing around Europe, broadening his mind, experiencing new things around away from mum and dad. Was Kirsty Allsop actually doing her son a service, being a parent that trusts her son, or was this reckless and you shouldn't go abroad on your own at that age?
I think it's hard to. It would be harsh to say it was reckless, but I definitely took a deep inhale when I read this story, and would have a number of concerns about a 50 or even a 16-year-old. Her justification seems to be he was only a few months off 16, and all these other 16-year-olds. I think I would be very anxious and nervous, and most parents would be, of allowing a child to go abroad at the age of 16. Of 15, 16 without adult supervision. I mean, there are a number of issues. You know, when children are left unsupervised in the UK, particularly if they're working class, there's a whole hoo-ha about poor parents and parents who have abandoned their children. So I'm not saying there should be a huge intervention or her child should be taken off her, but I understand why social services wanted to have a chat with her. I completely get it. And speaking as a parent, it's not something I would have allowed to happen for my children. Every parent knows their child best. Most parents know their children better than anyone else. And she made that assessment. But it's not unreasonable for the statutory authorities to actually understand how that assessment was made.
Emma?
This is absolutely ridiculous. Every child is different. There is no way that a 15-year-old is demonstrably different 3 weeks later when they suddenly magically turn 16, okay? First point. Second point, we have mobile phones. The child had her son Oscar had a mobile phone. He could have been in access in contact at any time. So communications are easier and safer than ever. He would have had access to her credit cards.
He's a foreign country,
Emma. Hold on. Hold on. Every child is different. I spoke to my mum. My mum has five kids. She said to me, Emma, you would have been ready to travel around Europe on your own at 14. Your big brother wouldn't have been ready to do that at the age of 19. Right?
That's my point.
No, I'm going to have my say now. Sorry. Every mother knows their children. Kirsty Allsop made a judgment that Oscar was absolutely fine. He was with 16-year-old friends. He did nothing illegal. Let me just say the facts, Stephen.
Well, I want to be able to talk to you as well. And Kula wants a conversation here. It's not a monologue, as you know. Let me ask you this. And then,
I've had two words.
Hold on. Are you telling me that in some circumstances, based on the maturity of someone, you think it would be all right for a 14-year-old? My goodness, why don't you go down to a 13 or 12-year-old traveling alone in Europe? At what point do you say no?
He wasn't alone. He was with friends who were 16.
But are you saying, let's distance it from this case and look more generally, are you saying that 14-year-olds and 13-year-olds could be...
No, I didn't say 13.
Well, what age?
I am saying you judge it on the child. I would say I would say 15 is absolutely fine. Probably 14 is too young. At the age of 14, I was traveling all over central London on my own with my little brother and sisters. At the age of 15, I traveled to Europe with my little brother, who was absolutely very young.
On your own, with your brother.
But that's my parents' judgment.
What age was your brother?
Stephen, I'm not going to reveal private information. But Stephen, it's every parent's judgment. Travel is now safer than ever. What angers me about this, Stephen, is that social services have so many important and really urgent cases they should be pursuing. They should have taken a judgment on this.
Social
services is very much about judgment. There are children out there living in domestic abuse situations, living in neglect and hunger and poverty. This is really, really shocking
Kula,
that they are going after a wealthy middle-class celebrity.
Kula.
Okay, so there's a couple of things. Let's not forget the age of a child in the UK and most countries across Europe is 18. So the 16-year-old threshold doesn't actually work for how we view a child. In the UK, children are not allowed to go to book hotels until they're 18. So, you know, we have this recognised cut-off. I absolutely, and I think I said it, every child is different and every parent will understand their child. So if social services get a report of potential neglect, whether it's a child, a parent is allowed a child to go on a holiday unsupervised across Europe under the age of 18, or whether they've gone on holiday and left their 15-year-old in the house on their own, the social services need to make that assessment. I don't care how much money you have in the bank, whether you're a celebrity, whether you're middle class, or whether you work in Tesco's. It's absolutely right that social services make that assessment and understand whether this is a case of neglect or whether it's a parent who, as Emma has said, has made an assessment that they believe their child is able to do it.
You therefore think if the parent makes the assessment, Kula,
sometimes parents need guidance. And we know that sometimes parents don't need a bit of support to make the right assessment. And the only way we can find that out is if we understand their reasoning behind it. I'm not saying that a parent should be prosecuted. I'm saying it's right that social services should understand on what basis she made that assessment.
But you are saying that in some cases it's all right for a 15-year-old.
Isn't it?
What about a 14-year-old, 13-year-old?
Stephen, I'm not saying it's all right. I'm saying I would never have done it. What I'm saying, though, as the point's been made, it's not illegal. I absolutely don't think it's okay. The point is, it's
tell
not,
me why.
Because
if the parent makes the assessment that the child is mature enough, and the parent knows the child more than anybody else, as has been discussed, why would you not support it? Why?
So I'm not saying I wouldn't. No, listen to me. I'm not saying I wouldn't support it. What I'm saying is, I personally wouldn't do it. But if a parent rang our parenting focus support line tomorrow and said, this is what I'm thinking, we would be very clear to give them, make sure they understood the law and understood chapter and verse.
Yeah, I just want to make it really clear that interrailing passes are available between the ages of 12 and 27, and nothing illegal was done here. He was traveling with 16-year-olds. And if I just want to have my say as well. If anything had happened, he could have been on mobile phone access to his parent in the UK at any point immediately. We have to be aware of that. It's not like it was in the olden days. And actually, children used to do a hell of a lot more, and in other countries, children are working from the age of 10, 12.
Emma, is it not all
15
is it not
years
all,
old
all right?
And was what, about not, to turn... If he had turned 16 a week later, because he's 21st of July, just like my little boy...
It wouldn't have been okay then either.
Just like my little boy, he would have been 16. So actually, Kula's saying 16 isn't okay. But the age of consent,
I'm saying
when do we deem people are okay to get on trains and travel around? Adventuring, exploring the world.
We're talking about hundreds of miles away across in different countries. We're saying that if my child, even my children are in their 20s, my child rang me and said, Mum, I'm in trouble and I'm in the middle of Spain somewhere, I would be panicking. How do I know she's getting the support? Now, she's an adult and it's okay. But if Kirsty Allsop has made that assessment, some parents who struggle, some parents don't always understand the boundaries, make incorrect assessments. And it's right that we understand those assessments. Let's be clear. A child is a child until they're 18. And we need to understand that they need additional protection. Parents are best placed to make those judgments. But sometimes they need support. And social services need to understand. You gave the case of, in your own family, a child of 14, 15, far more able to travel than a young person of 19. And some parents can make that assessment, some parents cannot. And where those parents cannot, social services need to know who they are so they can access proper supports for them. And that is all I am saying. My judgment as a parent would be, not on your nelly would I let my kids go. But that's my judgment as a parent knowing my children. The advice we would give parents is, you need to make a judgment, but you need to understand that there may be consequences, and one of those consequences may be a visit from social services. I'm assuming social services will have turned up, will have made that assessment, and will take reasonable action. They're not looking for work.
Look, when you look out in the cold-hearted light of day, Kula, the age of consent is 16. You can get married, yes, with your parents' permission, at 16.
And you can't vote till you're 18.
You can consent.
A child is not a child until the age of 18. A child
married.
Is a child until 16. Age of consent is 16. Getting married is 16.
No, can we not argue about something that's actual fact? A child is a child and he's subject to the protections of a child until they're the age of 18. There are evolving legal, as children get mature, we give them different responsibilities and the age changes. But as far as social services are concerned, a child is a child up until their 18th birthday. That is law. That is fact. The United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child says a child is a child.
Look, the other part of this, and look, when you do it, you realise how game-changing it is. Certainly for me, when I started travelling, so I travelled very young with a friend. I think I was 15.
Across Europe,
travelled to France.
All right, yeah.
Yes. I did. And then I went to these, I think it was called Camp America at the time, where I went off to America for 3 months at a time. I ended up running a summer camp. And when you travel when you're young, Kula, my goodness, does it broaden your mind.
100%.
It opens up this realization that a book can't do, and that telling people about it and watching it on TV doesn't do. When you meet people from around the world, it was game changing for me. It
of
was
course.
Incredible. It opens your mind up. So for those parents who decide, you know what, I want to stretch my child now. I want to let them experience something new. And they trust their child and they're sure their child is mature enough. Is that enough for you?
And that isn't, of course I understand that. Of course I understand that. But we also know that there are neglectful parents out there as well. Parents who need additional support. Parents who don't understand how to make those assessments. And how do we know which one is which unless we have a conversation with them, is all I'm saying. So what I'm assuming, and I don't know the detail, what I'm assuming is social services in London will have a conversation with Kirsty Allsop and her husband and make that assessment with them as to whether they made the decision to allow their child based on informed and understanding the kid and knowing and that all the measures were in place to make sure he had a safe and as enriching an experience as possible. But
let's see
what
we think at home.
And you talk about them every day. We know that there are parents who are struggling and sometimes don't make those decisions and their children are not mature enough. And in those cases, social services need to know where they are so they can access supports for them.
Here's Joy. Good morning, Joy.
I'm saying.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
I'm okay. Go ahead, Joy. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning to your guests. My view is this. For me personally, if, what's the name, Kirsty's son commits a crime, would she want him? I bet you, I'm a parent of two boys, she would want him to be treated as a child. Suddenly her wording would be, he didn't know what he was doing. He's still growing. He's a child. He's a this. But somehow, it was all well and good. He's adult enough to take a plane, get a ticket, and travel to a different country. I also wonder, as a parent, does she allow him to look after his brothers and sisters, clean the house top to bottom, cook a meal for the family, go and do the family shopping, take care of the home? I wonder if that's part of his independence, his growing up stage.
Joy, yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. John, next. Morning, John.
Morning.
Go ahead, John.
I travelled quite regularly, all over Europe, America, and so on.
When you were young?
And I had, yes.
What age?
First flight I took on my own, I think I was about 10.
What?
And I travelled many all through Europe, you name it, Australia, so on. You know, catching up with meeting, driving from one family to another family and backwards and forwards, and be left on my own in hotels. And I booked.
Why were you travelling? Why were you travelling as a 10-year-old on your own? Why?
I was trying to meet a family in Sydney. I was trying to meet friends in Paris, New York, because I got there.
I don't even know how you get on a plane on your own. Do they let you on a plane on your own as a 10-year-old?
If you're under the age of 12, you go in charge of stewardess.
Yeah, so...
BOC Airlines, British European Airlines, you know, and so on in those days. And there was never any trouble. And when I got to our site, I had my card that I was given to use. And
yeah, but of course, what's happening with Kirsty Allsop's son is that he is travelling. He's experiencing the cities and the environment. Like, you didn't, as a young person, do that. You were going to an adult, weren't you?
When I was 14, 15, I was whining and dining all over Europe.
Whining and dining?
Yeah. And staying in the best of hotels.
John, thank you. Michael, morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Morning. What do you think?
I would say that adventure is the basis of a really good education.
Until something goes wrong, Michael.
That's part of learning how to live, is how to deal with problems when they crop up. One of my sons hitched a lift along with a friend of his on a lorry from Five Mile Town that was delivering cheese to northern France. And it came back a week later. They hitched up over to France, hitched about the place, got into all wee bits of bother, one thing or another, landed, but got back to the lorry and back here. And it was an experience that was really very, very good for them.
Well, I'm going to tell you a wee story. Kula, are you still there?
Yes.
Yes, I am, Stephen.
I'm going to tell you both a wee story. So me and my friend Kenton, right? We went over to, this is a true story, we went over to France when I was 15, okay? And we didn't get there in the most conventional way, let's put it like that. So we get to France and we had very little money. And we were, what do you call it when you're flagging down a ride? You're hitching a ride.
Hitchhiking,
right? So we hitchhiked our way through some of France. I remember one time there were these two young fellas and they were driving this real sporty car. And so we get into the car, Michael, right?
Yeah.
And there's Kenton and I as two 15-year-olds sitting in the back of this car. And I noticed there was something a wee bit strange with the front of the car. It was a stolen car. They'd stolen the car.
Right?
They were joyriding. They were thieves. No, she's finding out now for the first time.
My God.
They were thieves. And they were racing up this road at about 100 miles an hour with him and I in the back of the car as two 15-year-olds. True story.
Right.
Now, they ended up being dead on to us. Obviously, they weren't dead on. They were criminals. But we actually couldn't believe it. Now, you see, now, if that happened to me, I'd take a heart attack. I would have fainted. You see, then... as you say, Michael, it was somehow part of an adventure. I'd wet myself if that happened to me now. Sure. But then it was an adventure. But what, Michael, if something had have gone wrong?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yes, but so things go wrong in life all the way through life. And if you don't build up experiences of getting into things to go wrong situations and somehow dealing with them or escaping from them or tolerating them, you're less able to lead a life. That's why I call it, I regard adventure in that generality as being the foundation for a good education. If you learn
15?
How to deal with problems that way, then you can deal with problems whenever you're studying advanced maths and you can't make head nor tail of this damn thing. And you haven't, but you have resiliences that have built up from youth.
30 seconds. Final word to you, Kula.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I like I said, it's absolutely right that we give children responsibility and we shouldn't thwart them with adventures. But the world is a big place. It's a fantastic place, but on occasion it can be scary. Kids have their whole lives in front of them, and if parents need to make sure they make the right decisions for their children, and children are children up until the age of 18. And we should take a measured approach, is all I'm saying. No one's wanting to hamper, but it's not wrong for social services to ask a few questions.
Kula, nice to talk to you today. Thanks, Emma, as well. Thank you, Michael. Thanks, everyone. See you tomorrow morning for more Nolan at 9.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Stephen Nolan Show!